ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you want to know who's really responsible for Donald Trump becoming president? It's Alan Funt. Yes. He's the man who invented reality TV, kind of by bugging people.
There was something kind of pervy and boundary crossing that isn't easy to sentimentalize.
I'm Mark Fennell, and that is just one exceptionally weird individual who changed the course of history, but trust me, there are more, and you'll hear about them. Just search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land. This, in one way or another, is a show about design and how it shapes society, often in entirely unexpected ways, in cities, houses and institutions. Later, the story of the QWERTY keyboard, how we wound up with this ungainly design that's likely to be with us forever. And we're travelling back a century when the horseless carriage took over the streets, for which they weren't designed, hence the criminalisation of pedestrians, the story of America, the automobile, and the invention of jaywalking. But first, how to design a prison. In the Norwegian forest near the Swedish border is a prison called Halden. It's built of pale timber and glass and polished steel. It's been called the world's poshest prison. And great claims are made that Halden has discovered the secret of rehabilitation through its architecture. Professor Yvonne Jukes is not so sure. Professor Jukes is a criminologist from Bath University and also a visiting fellow at Melbourne University. And she has helped design prisons in the United Kingdom, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, following her principles of rehabilitative design. And she's now written a memoir called An Architecture of Hope, Reimagining the Prison, Restoring a House, Rebuilding Myself, published by Scribe. Yvonne, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
Yvonne, tell us about Halden and the claims made for Halden and what you think of those claims.
I've spent quite a lot of time at Halden Prison. It's in the south of Norway. It's very close to the Swedish border. That in itself is a problem for a lot of prisoners who are sent there because it's remote. It's quite difficult to get to. But Halden, it is famed, and rightly so, around the world because real efforts were made to design and construct a beautiful prison. But the thing that I always say about it is that it looks beautiful to an outsider. It is a prison. At the end of the day, it is a prison. It has all the problems and issues of any other prison. It's a high security establishment. So prisoners go there with all the kinds of, mental health, physical health, addiction issues, very impoverished backgrounds often, as you would find in Australia or the UK. And when I've interviewed prisoners there, they've said, yes, we appreciate this attractive design, but we would trade it all for being able to see our children more often, or even just being able to speak to them on the phone every day. And prisoners are always really emphatic, saying, we know that on the outside it's called Hotel Halden, but it's not a hotel, it's a prison. And they keep saying that, it's a prison. The loss of liberty is everything. And I think the other thing that I would say about Halden Prison is the prison governor there and the prison authorities often make quite grand claims about Halden's reoffending rates. So they claim that the recidivism rate is around 22 to 25%. I don't know what it is in Australia, but in the UK, it's around 50%. I think it's probably similar in Australia. So on the face of it, that sounds great. But Recidivism rates are counted differently in different countries, different jurisdictions, and it's very difficult to compare between countries. And also, nearly 40% of prisoners who get sent to Halden are foreign nationals, and when they finish their sentence, they go back to their own countries. And it's just impossible to track them longitudinally. So we don't really know. And, you know, I think a lot of the claims that are made for Halden are, you know, a little bit exaggerated, let's say.
There's a detail in what you write about Halden that is just so like a prison anywhere in the world, that the prisoners can't make telephone calls unless a Norwegian-speaking guard can listen in to what they say. And therefore, for a prisoner who can only speak Arabic, no phone calls.
That's right. And prisoners feel that as a very punitive and cruel form of punishment. I mentioned in my book that during one interview, I was talking to someone from Turkey, and he actually spent the whole hour-long interview in tears because he'd been at Halden for a few years by then, and he hadn't been able to speak to his mum in Istanbul once during his imprisonment. And, you know, that was a real pain of imprisonment for him. And it's an odd sort of, you know, Norway is famed for its liberalism and its strong welfare state and so on, but it does have quite deep pockets of draconian practice and censoring communications, monitoring 100% of phone calls rather than it just being intelligence led is one of those quite draconian practices that, you know, that people aren't necessarily aware of.
Before we get to your idea of how a prison should be designed, there are obviously aspects of Halden that you admire.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, you know, as an outsider, you go in and you see these beautiful larch-faced buildings, and it's on a large piece of land. It's a big footprint, so you can walk around the grounds. Halden is actually built into a forest, and the forest encroaches within the wall. So although you can see this huge, great concrete wall from every part of the prison, the view is sort of softened by the trees. And, you know, it feels like quite a pleasant place to be. And also, one great thing about a lot of the North European and Nordic countries is that in any capital bill project, 1% of the budget has to be spent on art. So there's a lot of art and sculpture at Halden, and I think that in itself is quite a civilizing thing. But, you know, there are always problems with prisons. So, for example, there is a beautiful therapeutic garden at Halden, planted with lush planting, you know, sensory plants, plants that smell gorgeous, et cetera, et cetera. But it's kept locked for most of the time because, you know, they don't have the staff, they don't have the numbers of staff to escort prisoners to the garden. And so it's an underused resource. And I see that over and over again everywhere in the world, that kind of thing goes on. So you have to look beneath the surface of any prison.
Do you think a prison like Halden would ever be built in Europe again or in this day and age?
No, Halden won't be built again in Norway. It's a very expensive prison. It was expensive to build. It cost the same amount as our new build prisons in the UK, but it only has a tenth of the residents. And it's hugely expensive to operate. The biggest cost involved in any prison is staff costs. And because it's on such a big footprint, you need a lot of people to staff it, a lot of officers to escort prisoners to education and the workshops and so on and so forth. So actually, in Norway, the prisons that have been built since Halden would be much more recognisable to us as, you know, more conventional institutions. And also, Norway politically has moved a little bit more to the centre-right.
That's what I was getting. That's what I was getting at, because there seems to be an unequivocal promise by governments in Europe, and it's certainly true in Australia, that prisons are there to punish.
Yes. I mean, a lot of people think that prisons can punish and rehabilitate, and I believe that the two things are mutually exclusive, that they can't do both. My view is always that, you know, people ask me, why should we give criminals nice environments? And there are some offenders who really test me on that. And I talk about Anders Breivik in my book, who, of course, killed 77 people in Norway. And my answer to that would always be that because we are an advanced civilization, because it says something about us as a society, and because the vast majority of people in prison will be released and they will be our neighbours. And we have to ask ourselves, who do we want as our neighbour? Someone who's been in prison and been alienated and brutalised by their environment, or someone who's been given hope and a feeling of investment in their future and in society? And actually, at the end of the day, good design costs no more than bad design.
Yes. So though you're sceptical of the claims made for Haldon, you're nevertheless devoted to the notion of rehabilitative design. And I'm wondering what the principles of that are.
We have a network of cancer care centres in the UK called MAGGIES, and there are a few around the world as well. But they were set up to be healing environments. They are trauma-informed. And I use them as an exemplar with the prison architects that I work with. So MAGGIES are based on principles of beautiful architecture, architecture that inspires and heals rather than harms, maximum exploitation of natural daylight, domestic in feel. You walk into a MAGGIES centre and you're immediately in the kitchen, you're offered a cup of tea. All these are things that I've, you know, principles that I've taken into to prisons. I think prisoners' reception areas are really important. When a prisoner has been in an escort vehicle, travelled, you know, perhaps many miles in very uncomfortable conditions, actually to arrive at a prison and to be offered a cup of tea and something to eat makes a huge difference. And I think it's just one of the things that I always ask architects that I work with to think about is, if a relative of yours was imprisoned in this institution that you're designing, would you be confident that they not only could survive, but that they could thrive and flourish? And that's something that most architects don't think to ask themselves. They don't think of it as an embodied experience, but that can really focus their minds.
You were invited by the New Zealand Department of Corrections to help design a new Supermax prison in Auckland. How did that go?
Not well, David, to be honest. I was engaged by a consortium put together by Fletcher, the construction company. And I was working with a team of really good people, everyone from the project lead, the architects, the civil engineers. We were all on the same page. And we thought we were all on the same page with the Department of Corrections, who told us that they wanted a humane, radically different kind of maximum security prison. Auckland East was going to be the only max security prison in the whole of the country. And, you know, all the signs were positive, and we all thought that we were working in the same direction. Unfortunately, when we came up with our master plan and showed it to the Department of Corrections, they looked at it and they said, we thought this is what we wanted, but actually now we've seen it, we realise that what we actually wanted was a newer, shinier version of the Supermax we already had. And the team was disbanded and I was sent home. And, you know, they've got something that is better than the prison it replaced, which was built in 1968, Paramaremo, very infamous prison. It's better in all sorts of ways, but it's also, it's still a supermax, and it's quite a brutal, grim environment. And, you know, the statistics on prison assaults and prison staff violence and, you know, across the whole range of indices actually show that it's really not working as a rehabilitative prison.
Yvonne, I hate to say this of anything in New Zealand, but what the department said to you sounds like bullshit. If they ordered a prison, gave you the specifications, told you what the mood of the place was to be, and then you delivered, whose mind was changed really here?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I wasn't privy to the kind of political machinations going on, and, you know, the sort of the behind the scenes fears and concerns about public opinion. And I think, you know, public opinion drives a lot of penal policy in all our countries. And, you know, I think that's as true in New Zealand as anywhere. The popular media there has a lot to answer for. And also, you know, the underlying racism of criminal justice. I'm not sitting in a glass house throwing stones here. The UK is just as bad. But, you know, the number of Maori prisoners in New Zealand's prisons is shocking, and it points to discrimination in social welfare policy and criminal justice policy right through the system. And, you know, there's just a kind of sense of otherness. I remember sitting in an office with members of the Department of Corrections from New Zealand, and I was telling them about prisons in Denmark, which happened to have quite a serious gang problem. And a senior psychologist from the Department of Corrections in New Zealand started shouting at me and pointing her finger, jabbing her finger at me and saying, "You don't understand our prisoners. Our prisoners are bigger than your prisoners. Our prisoners are more violent than your prisoners." And that's an attitude that is really deeply entrenched in New Zealand corrections.
On ABC Radio National Summer, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking prison design with Yvonne Jukes, Professor of Criminology at Bath University and Honorary Visiting Fellow at Melbourne University. Yvonne, it strikes me that one of the roles of prisons is to look forbidding to passers-by. They are supposed to look like the embodiment of a punishing state.
That's certainly the case with ancient prisons. You know, 19th century prisons are very carefully scripted. Their facades are all about giving a warning to people in the community. You know, don't break the law or you could end up in somewhere as forbidding as this. And that's why a lot of 19th century jails look like medieval castles or dungeons, you know. And they definitely have that sort of watch and beware function about them.
Abandon hope.
All ye who enter here. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so much of it derived from sort of fiction, isn't it? If there's a sort of a romantic novelist view of the terrifying jail.
Yeah, the Gothic horror.
Gothic horror. But inside, Yvonne, I wonder whether one of the most rehabilitative things about a prison might be decent plumbing.
Well, that's an interesting question. I've never been asked about the plumbing before. But yeah, those 19th century jails were ahead of their time in terms of heating, you know, the engineering, the plumbing and so on. Now they're largely not fit for purpose because they're 200 years old. Prisons now, I mean, certainly in the UK and I think in Australia as well, tend to be no longer built in sort of busy urban conurbations.
Yes, you're right. They're not on the highways anymore.
No, they're not. They're in quite remote areas. And in the UK, they're often on sort of adjacent to business parks and that kind of thing. So people don't walk past them. And I think there's a problem with that as well, that prisoners are being sequestered, sort of separated, out of sight, out of mind.
Yvonne, one thing, if there was one thing that prisons had to fix to be more rehabilitative, what would it be? One thing.
Halve prison populations. I honestly believe that most countries could halve their prison populations with no detrimental impact on crime whatsoever. And I think we should be looking to abolish the female prison estate. There are only a handful of women in prison in any country who have committed violent crimes and are a danger to society. 21% of women in prison in the UK are in for shoplifting, and very often it's a crime of necessity. You know, we criminalise poverty. You know, women are in prison for stealing nappies and baby formula. You know, that's not the mark of a civilized society to me. So I think we should actually get rid of a lot of prisons, and then with the smaller number of remaining establishments for a tiny fraction of who we currently send to prison, we could set about building, you know, truly rehabilitative, trauma informed, gender sensitive institutions.
Yvonne, thank you. It's not often we hear an expert really arguing that they should be put out of business, really.
That's right.
Thanks for talking to us on Late Night Live. I've been speaking to Yvonne Jukes, Professor of Criminology at Bath University, about the design of prisons, but more to the point about her new book, An Architecture of Hope, published by Scribe. This is Late Night Live. Coming up, the invention of jaywalking. For centuries, streets were places for people. For people and horses and carts and bicycles, all making their own way at their own pace. They were open space. Mothers sent their children to play in the street. But a century ago, against angry opposition, Los Angeles handed its streets over to the automobile, and the world followed. But now American cities are fighting back. The latest, as of last year, is New York, where people are free once more to jaywalk. Other cities are set to follow, abolishing relic laws, as the abolishers call them. Relic laws that only ensnare people in the criminal legal system. Peter Norton has been watching American pedestrians reclaiming the street. Peter is Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and the author of several books on the age of the automobile, how the car reshaped American cities, and how pedestrians became, for a century at least, pariahs. Peter, welcome to Late Night Live.
It's a pleasure to be with you, David.
Peter, what were streets like when the first automobiles, when the first cars nosed down them?
It was a place for people. It was a public space. And Australia and the U.S. have a lot in common in this respect because of our inheritance of the British common law tradition. And so even the judges, even the officialdom, stood for the right of the pedestrian, including the child, to roam into the street. In fact, judges in that tradition, in Britain, in America, in Canada, in Australia, New Zealand, all stood by and defended this right of even children to the unaccompanied use of the streets. And what this meant was that the responsibility for safety lay with those who stood to endanger others with their vehicles. And when motor vehicles were new, that meant the motorist was the responsible party.
But this was holding the industry back by the 1920s.
That's exactly right. So if you are thinking about buying an automobile in, say, 1910 or 1920, as they're becoming much more common, one reason why you might refuse to buy one, even if you could afford it, was that if you lived in a city or a town, you were constantly having to pause to let pedestrians roam across the street, and they had the legal priority to do so. And if you weren't yielding out of courtesy, then you were probably yielding out of self-interest, because the legal liability lay on your shoulders as the motorist, no matter where you injured a pedestrian. The pedestrian could be in the middle of the street and not looking, but the responsibility still lay on you, the motorist. And that was an obstacle to sales. And because it was an obstacle to sales, people who wanted to sell automobiles worked to change that.
And how did they go about that task?
Well, they had many different ways. Some of them worked better than others. One of the ways that didn't work so well was to just use your influence as a business group, like an automobile club or an automobile dealers association, and get your influence expressed in the form of a law restricting walking in streets. And there was such a law in Kansas City, Missouri, in 1912, but it was not a big success because local people resented it. After all, from their point of view, streets were for everybody, and the law was on their side historically in that respect. But this new local law was at odds with that, so it really earned the contempt of a lot of local people. And so that was the kind of strategy that did not succeed. What makes Los Angeles the real pioneer was that even though it came later than Kansas City and didn't have a real ordinance of this kind until 100 years ago, 1925, it pursued a much more effective strategy. The business associations that wanted this to work were very clear that to make it work, they needed to change minds as well as change laws and to deploy psychological and social pressure techniques like making pedestrians feel ashamed or embarrassed or attract ridicule to them. And in fact, the word jaywalker comes from a term of derision, Midwestern U.S. slang from the Kansas-Missouri area. In that slang, a jay was a foolish throwback from another era, somebody not in step with the 20th century, a rural hick or rube. And so even the word jaywalker itself reflects the fact that success would require psychology as well as law.
And there were jay drivers as well, I understand.
That's exactly right. In fact, jay driver and jay walker began at about the same time, obviously in the part of America where jay actually meant anything, that this term of slang was not well known in most of the U.S. It was well known in the middle of the country, where probably by association with the jay bird, which says a lot but doesn't know anything, a jay was a foolish person. And it was a useful prefix. You could put it in front of anything you wanted. You could have a jay town, and that would be a town without a theater or a library. And you could have a jay walker, and that would be somebody who didn't know how to walk in the 20th century city. But it could also be jay driver, which would mean somebody who didn't know how to drive even a wagon in the city. And so they drove in such a way that they obstructed other people. And jay driver and jay walker began at about the same time, about 1905, but Jay Walker had a big, powerful collection of business groups out to promote the word, which is why that was the word that survived while Jay Driver withered and died on the vine.
Now, not a rube, not somebody who didn't know his way around, was Miller McClintock. Tell us about this guy who really, for the most of the world, defined the notion of the street.
That's right. So Miller McClintock was a young man in 1924. At that time, he was 30 years old. He was a Chaucer scholar in college, hoping to find something more lucrative. So he was pursuing a PhD, and he was writing a dissertation about traffic, which was motor traffic, was a brand new subject for cities, and he thought that was his opportunity. And he was on a study tour for his dissertation, taking the train to U.S. cities to study their traffic conditions. When he got to Los Angeles, he met somebody who saw a real opportunity in Miller McClintock to get the change that he wanted. That man that he met was named Paul Hoffman, who was Los Angeles's most successful automobile dealer. Now, automobile dealers were, as we've already discussed, very threatened by the laws that favored pedestrians, because not only did drivers have to slow down for pedestrians, but drivers were also legally liable for injuring pedestrians anywhere in the street. So Hoffman, who was very influential in Los Angeles, he had the attention of everybody on city council, was facing a dilemma. He couldn't write a new traffic law for Los Angeles himself because he was an automobile dealer. That would just look odd on its face. But he thought, I can get this young man, Miller McClintock, to write it for me. And he has academic credentials. He's working on a dissertation on traffic. We'll make him the first expert on traffic. And I'll influence him to make sure he writes this traffic law the way I want it. And that's exactly what Miller McClintock did. It was extremely lucrative, as it happened, for Miller McClintock, but also very beneficial to Hoffman, too, because he got that Los Angeles traffic ordinance of 1925, which went into effect exactly 100 years ago, not because the people of Los Angeles voted for it or demanded it. In fact, there, as you said in your introduction, there was a lot of resentment about it. It happened because Paul Hoffman was a very shrewd businessman, and Miller McClintock was a very good drafter of just the kind of traffic ordinance that Hoffman wanted.
And so was created in law a new category of person, the jaywalker. Now, Peter, I have to confess to being a lifelong jaywalker, and I know that I'm going to die probably doing what I've loved so much through my life, which is jaywalking. And jaywalking remains a human passion, don't you think? It has not been eliminated by laws all around the world.
That's exactly right. In fact, if you look at where people go, people who have the means to holiday where they want, if they go to a city or a town, they always choose the one where people are roaming freely. I mean, if you go to a beautiful old Renaissance city in Italy or Paris or maybe a city in the Caribbean, as many Americans like to go to, or in Mexico, this is where Americans holiday. People who holiday in Europe pick beautiful old cities with squares that are popular with people strolling and walking. And I think it tells us something about what makes a city work. What makes a city work, we can't just measure by the number of automobiles per hour on a road. That could just be a highway interchange, not a real city at all. If we measure a city's vitality properly, then I think we would find that the more walking there is, the more you have a thriving city.
Absolutely true in the case of Australia. You can go to respectable cities in this country. I'm not going to name them, of course, because we have loyal listeners in those cities. But there can be not a car in sight, and yet they will not walk across the lights. It's extraordinary.
Yes, I think you're pointing to something that I see here as well, which is after a few generations of normalizing this sort of car dominant situation, many people, even when they're walking, behave as though the automobile is the superior entity. They will yield to it even where they have the right of way. Almost every day in my town in Virginia, from the window of my office, I can watch as young American college students wait at marked crosswalks where they have the right of way until there's no car in sight, and then they will finally cross. So I think we're seeing the success of the effort to plant in our minds the notion that the automobile's right to the street is superior. I'm reminded of something Germans said when the country reunified. They said that long after reunification, they still had a wall in their minds. And I think as we are re-examining what we want our cities in Australia and America to be, we still often find that the biggest impediments are in our minds, because we all grew up learning in school and from authority figures and in safety lessons and films that the automobile is the superior right, has the superior right to the street, and we should defer to it everywhere. And I think it's time to question that.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Peter Norton about the invention of the jaywalker about 100 years ago in America. Now, look, the Los Angeles development spread around the world. Why? Because it worked?
Well, in a word, yes. But the particulars are that in the U.S., the automobile interest groups, mainly the automobile clubs and the automobile dealers, got together and said, look, we want the Los Angeles example to be the example for the whole country. They lobbied successfully to have a model municipal traffic ordinance drafted, and by that I mean a traffic ordinance that any city could just plug in without having to write it themselves. And they got the U.S. government to put its seal of approval on it through the United States Department of Commerce, and it proliferated such that today in 2025, in most of America, the local ordinance that you are working under as you walk about the streets is in some way descended from that Los Angeles ordinance. And because the U.S. was early to motorize, early to adopt the automobile, as other countries followed and motorized as well, they looked to the U.S. example to see how they could promote their automobile-centered agendas as well. That includes in Australia and especially in the English-speaking world, this was the U.S. was the model or the pattern. So the National Roads and Motorists Association in Australia served a role closely analogous to the American Automobile Association in the U.S. of promoting the interests of drivers, often at the expense of pedestrians.
Did these new rules actually save lives?
No. That's how they were always sold. But I've read the internal conversations among the people who were promoting these rules and claiming that they would save lives. But what they say among themselves is this will finally let us sell more cars and let us have higher speed limits and make life as a motorist less of a nuisance and more of a pleasure. So I think the motive was clear. It's not me reading the motive into it. They were pretty clear about their motive themselves, and that was to sell more cars and to make driving easier. But to make that claim more palatable, they said their motives were safety. Now, it can be counterintuitive. You tell somebody that you actually make walking more hazardous by restricting jaywalking, and they'll question you, and it's a very reasonable question, but I think it works like this. The more everyday and normal and routine and common you make walking, and the easier and more convenient you make walking, the more people walk. And the more people walk, the safer walking is. It's the safest to walk in a city like Amsterdam or Florence or many other cities around the world where walking is very common, because then the drivers are all on the alert all the time for walkers. And this means that walking is safer, and walking is the most dangerous wherever it's uncommon. So in the U.S., what we call the Sun Belt cities, and that means the cities, particularly in the southern and southwestern states, are notoriously dangerous because everything was designed for drivers, and therefore walking is rare. And because walking is rare, the drivers drive fast and don't pay attention, with the result that walking is also very dangerous in those places.
But the rules against jaywalking in the United States have, over time, become used against blacks.
Yes. There's a long history in the U.S. going back to Reconstruction, the era after the Civil War, and even into the slavery era, where law enforcement was, to some degree, associated with racial policing. So, for example, fugitive slaves were a law enforcement problem when slaves escaped from their owners. In the Reconstruction era in the South after the Civil War, often it was police departments who made sure that despite emancipation and the end of slavery, black people knew their place, so to speak. In other words, knew that they were the subordinate race in that racial caste system. So policing in the U.S. has a history of this, and it spread all over the country. It was not limited to the South. It was also very significant in U.S. cities because so many Southern black Americans moved to the cities in the 20th century. And this meant that local white populations that were already there saw police as a way to protect them from this perceived threat. So because of these legacies of history in American policing, policing has often been used in the U.S. As a way to control or constrain black people. And jaywalking laws were a convenient way to do that, because while most people jaywalk whenever it's convenient to do so, police could selectively enforce it against black people as a way of exerting control. And there have been studies that show that, in fact, black Americans were much more likely to be stopped for jaywalking than a jaywalking white American doing the same kind of infraction. There have even been experiments where white volunteers and black volunteers jaywalked, and the black ones were far more likely to be stopped. That's one reason why there has been some retreat from the jaywalking laws that were ubiquitous until very recently.
How big is that retreat going to be, do you think?
So far, it's very small. I mean, it's not insignificant. The whole state of California passed a law called the Freedom to Walk Act 2 years ago that did not exactly abolish jaywalking, but made it much less restrictive. The whole state of Virginia, where I live, did the same thing. New York City has as well. But it's not really a tide of change. It seems to have run its course. I think there was some momentum following the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis in 2020. But, you know, as every listener to your program, I'm sure, will know, there's been a backlash now in this country. And that now there's a pause on this reexamination of racial injustice in law.
But surely Donald Trump stands above all things for the freedom to cross a street whenever you want. I mean, isn't that MAGA?
You know, I would think exactly that, but we don't expect logic from MAGA, or at least I don't. I don't want to presume anything, but I don't expect logic in MAGA, and the MAGA logic inherited an older logic in the U.S. that connects driving with freedom, and any restriction on driving is therefore a restriction of freedom. And for that reason, you know, efforts to relax laws against jaywalking get misrepresented as laws that restrict motorists' freedom. So it's very easy for MAGA to object to anything that relaxes the jaywalking laws.
Peter, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live to bring us up to date on this.
It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking to Peter Norton, Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia, who is the author of several books and papers on automobiles and America and how they have shaped the life of not just that country, but the world, including Street Rivals, Jaywalking, and the Invention of the Motor Age Street. Coming up, that damned QWERTY keyboard. I taught myself to touch type when I was 14. It was step one in becoming a great novelist. I sat inside all summer with a chart on the wall and a cast iron typewriter hidden under a bib. Now, the novels never came, but it's just about the most useful thing I have ever learnt in my life. But the layout made no sense at all. Why, from left to right in the top line, the letters QWERTY, QWERTY? It's the keyboard we all know by heart. But in the English alphabet, it makes no sense at all. It goes way back to the first typewriters of the 19th century, said to be deliberately awkward in a way to stop early machines jamming. Faster and more efficient layouts are available. Why can't we make the change? Are we stuck with QWERTY forever? Gianfranco Di Giovanni is an ABC tech journalist, and he joins me now from the West. Gianni, welcome to the show.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Now, look, is it true that the keyboard was designed to be deliberately awkward?
Well, that has always been the rumor, and it was the one that I was told as I was learning to use the keyboard myself, that it was actually designed to slow people down as they were tapping away at their typewriters, that the mechanical little pins that would hit against the paper and the ribbon to put mark on there, you'd slow them down so you stopped yourself from jamming. But apparently that isn't as true as we would have thought, but the actual layout of the keyboard, it's kind of had a bit of an evolution over time. And as you said, in the 19th century, as typewriters became more common, people were kind of a bit more, becoming more familiar with them. But David, did you know that the first keyboards that people would type on actually really resembled the keys of a piano?
So they were long.
They were relatively long. They were kind of stacked, a bit like a small little keyboard you might see at a DJ set or something like that. But they actually really had those black and white keys you'd be very familiar with on a piano keyboard, effectively. And that's what they look like. And that was the first sort of style of them. And using that was in A to Z, that sort of style format of actually typing out that way. But that particular format was not super efficient for the people who had come to be the most frequent users of that particular type of keyboard.
HZ would be as ridiculous as QWERTY, wouldn't it?
Because yes.
Don't you want the letters you most use sort of under your fingers?
Effectively, yeah.
Effectively.
And so, yeah, so when you were learning to type, did you learn about the home row, which is that kind of middle set of keys that you have, the AS, DF, GH, J? I'm looking at mine in front of me now as I'm going
to.
And so those particular rows, you would sit your fingers across, and you'd often have your thumb sitting on the space bar as well, as you would kind of go to type, and you'd be reaching to the bottom and the top rows as you go and kind of typing in that sort of orientation. And so the people that originally were using a lot of typing and were the people who were in communication, much like we are, they were sending messages. So it was the original telegraph offices which became the sort of, you know, test bed for those original typewriters, and they were the ones that found that the sort of original layout, which resembled a keyboard on a piano, was the one that was causing issues and didn't quite make sense as you were trying to get a message down.
So the keyboard was rearranged so that it came in decks. And then you talk about people sending messages. So Morse code has a part of this story.
It does, yeah. So Christopher Latham Sholes was the inventor of one of the many different competing types of typewriters and typewriter keyboards. And, you know, they've said that, you know, he's one of, you know, the 50-odd people who's tried to come at this one. But he actually came across something that was a pretty clever way to get it into the familiarity of many people who needed to type. So the first typewriter that he made, he was a printer by trade in 1868. Was sold off to Porter's Telegraph College, the people who would be sending messages around the United States in Chicago. And that was where that particular style sort of started to bed in as people kind of became familiar with it, and the speed of that particular layout tended to be the one that people started to learn. And so it was originally licensed off to Remington, which people might know as, like, you know, if you've watched cowboy movies, the Remington rifles and things like that. So that same company was also making typewriters and machinery at that time, and they used that layout as their one, and they also very cleverly got people to learn how to use this. You buy this particular piece of equipment and hey, we'll teach you how to use it at the same time. And so people who needed to learn how to type were using this particular model, and then they were using this particular layout, and as you got better at it, that was the one that kind of stuck.
So QWERTY spread.
Yeah, that's right. And so what probably also helped was, you know, a bit of old-fashioned monopolies here. They the Remington company basically took over about four of their rivals. And so that particular QWERTY format became the sort of standard format that many other people started to use. And so with so much of technology and so many of the things that we use, you just think of the inertia that's there and the sort of time loss or the risk of potentially learning how to do a different piece of technology. And it just becomes easier for everyone to kind of adopt one standard. And in many circumstances, that's really good when we've got a really quite efficient and familiar layout of a keyboard. But in modern technology, we think, oh, you know, everyone wants to use this particular app to do something, and it becomes hard to switch over if all of your friends are using the same one.
This is ABC Radio National Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Gianfranco Di Giovanni, who goes by Gianni, about the development of the keyboard. Now, Gianni, obviously from early on, people were looking to better systems. Were any of these better systems ever on the brink of being introduced?
Well, yes, there's a very famous layout called the Dvorak layout, which was developed by August Dvorak, and that came in around the 1930s. But if you think about the timeframes we were talking about before, sort of the late 19th century, the 1870s, 1868, sort of that time frame, there's been basically about, you know, 60-odd years or so by the time that this competing format came about. And so there was some testing that was done, including by the US military, where they said that this Dvorak format, which has, you know, slightly different orientation of keys. In fact, you know, if you look at the numbers on your keyboard, those numbers were not in number order. They were like seven and a bunch of different things.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's all over the place, right? And so you could kind of say, okay, the letters might want to go where they're most frequently, but kind of you would think that numbers should be in the order that they're in. So anyway, that was one of the ones that was supposed to be more efficient at typing. But the problem was there's this kind of technical debt that comes with having a piece of technology that you use, and the cost of having to learn something new is often too much for people to bear. So while the Dvorak sort of format style of keyboard layout is popular for some, it's a bit of a niche and you can buy keyboards or you can go and change your keyboards if you've got a fancy one into that particular layout, it isn't one that ever managed to take off because there was just too much inertia behind QWERTY and too many people knew how to use it.
But couldn't they say, you know, from this time forward, everybody will be trained on Dvorak?
Has that ever worked? Has that ever worked in the past?
No.
I mean, America still sticks with, you know, pounds and inches and all of those sorts of things. So there's too much of inertia behind that particular, even though the rest of the world has moved on. So, you know, I think it's a nice idea. And actually, did you know you can actually go and change the layout on your phone keyboard to a Dvorak layout if you choose? Like, actually, the modern phones actually do support that. So if you were really thinking about, oh, let's give that a go, it's something you could pull out of your pocket and have a play with, just have a look at the way that it goes, you know, and try type it out and see if it actually works more efficiently for you.
Who are the prisoners of QWERTY? Is it only English speakers?
There is quite a few countries that are actually using that QWERTY format. There's a variety of different standards that they have, an ISO format, an ANSI format, and a JIS format. And the JIS in particular is the Japanese one, which I wanted to talk to you about, because it actually uses that QWERTY format, but it actually has a way in which you can type out like a transliterated Japanese word. So Romaji is the way that you type out, you know, how you would see Japanese names spelt in English. You type the words out as you would, and then it gets turned into hiragana and katakana as well, the two like Japanese writing scripts. So it actually uses a familiar enough keyboard that we would be looking at in front of us, and most of us in Australia. And
a QWERTY board.
A QWERTY board, basically, yeah.
So
and it uses that in a different language.
I've always wondered how that works, because obviously you can't have a keyboard with, you know, several thousand symbols on it. So they type in a transliteration.
In Japanese in particular, yes.
A transliteration and it types the symbols.
Yeah, so for example, if you typed in Tokyo, as we would spell Tokyo out on the keyboard, then it would give you the character for Tokyo as it translated through. So that's, you know, very similar to some of the other languages that use non-English characters, and Arabic, for example, has a version of that too. And, you know, there are different versions though, which for languages which still use the Latin script as we write it, there are a number of different types. So, for example, Turkish uses a QWERTY, which has a slightly different format. The French, in French-speaking places in Africa, people in Belgium, for example, use a QWERTY as a format, which is very similar, but has a few of their more popular letters put into slightly different locations. And the Germans and the German-speaking parts of the world use QWERTY instead of QWERTY as well. So there's a variety of different slightly adjusted models on the way that we would type, but mostly pretty familiar to what we would have seen in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s.
So somebody from then could jump forward in time and sit down happily and type, except... How long is it since you've tried to type on an old keyboard, on a keyboard that types onto paper? It's terribly difficult.
Yeah, it's not an... Well, you know, I think there's a romance to it in a way that is quite enjoyable. But can I tell you as well that, like, so in the 1960s, there was IBM. Obviously, many people would know IBM as a computing company. They were a business machines company, and they built electric typewriters. There was a famous one called the IBM Selectric. And that format of keyboard that they used actually ended up being the sort of 1980s-style Model M keyboard, which is iconic, which most people would, like, be familiar with if they're using a computer. And that sort of, you know, that grey sort of beigey sort of look that you would see is actually a type of keyboard that is really sought after for people today, because it used a mechanical function, which is much similar to that typewriter function. It actually has little switches and buttons and stuff. And so mechanical keyboards these days, particularly in the sort of computer enthusiast space, are really, really popular. And I've got one right here, and I'm going to just play a little bit of this sound. Can you just hear that clacking away? That sort of
It's the sound of a newsroom.
It is, isn't it? It's beautiful.
The Sydney Morning Herald newsroom with a couple of hundred people.
Exactly.
I know. Exactly. I know. I'm being over romantic here.
But they're kind of beautiful, and I think people who do in that specialist, like enthusiast of those beautiful keyboards, people do spend a lot of time, and they go and change the mechanism, and they go and change the build of the old thing. They change the cables, so there is a romance that's kind of associated with the keyboard for people who really love that style, and it sticks around till today.
Gianni, thank you so much for explaining this. Gianfranco Di Giovanni, ABC tech journalist. He's also the content director at ABC Local Perth Radio, from where he's been speaking to the show. And that's the show. On our next, we ask, can a close study of feathers solve crimes? back then.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.